Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You would think that covering religion would be a little bit like covering the movement of glaciers. Not much happens fast. There is movement there, but it doesn't happen very quickly. It happens, well, glacially, doesn't it? Although, one might argue in the last 30 years, there has been more movement, more change on the religious landscape of America and elsewhere than practically any place else. Some really startling change. It remains newsworthy, but how does it remain newsworthy? Pope says something here and there, or maybe a religious leader has something to say, or in the case of, say, lately, Bill Hybels, a religious leader, has kind of a notorious resignation. That kind of stuff makes news. How do you reflect upon news coverage over the last 30 years? Terry Mattingly, a regular guest here on the program, has been doing just that for the last 30 years, reflecting on religion news and noticing some trends. He joins us to talk about them on this Thursday afternoon. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
First of all, congratulations on 30 years yesterday, writing this weekly column on religion.
Well, thank you very much. It's the sort of thing that it's been a part of my life so long that it's hard to remember what life was like before doing this column. 5 years ago, I thought the column was going to end when the Scripps Howard News Service closed its doors in Washington, D.C., and for about 5 days, I thought the column was dead. But then I was contacted by the Universal Press Syndicate, and it lived on. But during those 5 days, I walked around quite a bit going like, I don't have a column to write this coming Tuesday. Like, what's this? You know, I didn't know what my life was like without that deadline built into the middle of it. It's been about 1,000. I figured, you know, did a little calculation, you know, a couple of vacations here and there. It's in the neighborhood of about 1,550 columns.
I'm going to ask you to remember a little bit of what it was like before, in that I'd like your answer to the question, how did you get started writing about religion?
Oh, well, that started in college. And basically, my college mentor, David McCam, who's still alive and well and just finally retired at the age of 83, I think, a year or two ago, at Baylor University, David witnessed a scene between me and the members of the Baylor newspaper staff where I came in all fired up about this story about the fact that they held foreign missions weekend at Baylor, and almost nobody showed up. And I thought it was a big story that nobody showed up, I mean, because this is Baylor. I mean, the largest Baptist institution in the world, you should have medical missionary wannabes lined up around the block. And the students said, the other students on the newspaper staff said, well, if nobody showed up, it's not a story. And I said, it's a story because nobody showed up, because this is Baylor. And the argument went back and forth, and finally I looked up, and my mentor, David McCam, was standing over in a door listening to this, and he gave me that little finger waggle you do when you want someone to come see you. So I walked across over there, and David said, these students have already picked up that the mainstream press doesn't think religion is important. Now, they didn't get that from me. He said, I think religion is the single worst covered subject in the American press. And then there's this long pause, and it's one of those pauses that precedes a big change in your life. Because then McCam asked, want to do something about it? And I'm a junior in college, sophomore in college, actually. in 1974. And I said, yeah, I think I would like to do something about that. And I set off on the path of trying to become a professional religion writer.
How did the On Religion column get started?
I was at the Rocky Mountain News in Denver, and I was writing a column for the Denver audience. But every now and then, one of my pieces would go out on the national Scripps Howard News Wire out of D.C. And there was this meeting of the editors and managing editors of the entire chain. And a man named Harry Moskos, good Greek Orthodox guy, in Knoxville, Tennessee, of all places, said, our newspaper, the Knoxville News Sentinel, which is now the newspaper that goes in my front driveway every morning, he said, we're going to start a section on family and faith, and we would love to have a lead column. And what we've noticed is that whenever we run things by this Mattingly guy out in Denver, people respond. People like this stuff. Why don't we write him a separate contract from his contract with the newspaper there and have him write once a week for the whole syndicate? And that's how it got started. When I left the Rocky Mountain News at the end of 1990, I assumed the column might vanish. But ever since then, I have been involved in academia as my basic day job has always been academic linked. I mean, even Get Religion is linked to an academic institution, and I'm still teaching. And what they said was, if you had joined like a political think tank or a religious think tank or something, you couldn't keep doing the column, but you're going to go teach at a seminary. It was Denver Theological Seminary at that point. And that sounds to me like it makes you more of a religion expert than you were before. Why don't you just keep writing it and we'll see how it goes? And 27 years later after that, it's still going.
We're going to be talking with you about trends in religion news. And you say that this thesis from James Davidson Hunter, I think it's almost 20 years old, Culture Wars, explains almost everything you need to know. What do you mean?
Well, it's James Davison, D-A-V-I-S-O-N. He is probably one of America's two or three best-known sociologists of religion. He teaches at the University of Virginia. And when I wrote my 10-year anniversary column, which was 1998, I dedicated it to James Davison Hunter. And Hunter had written a book that everybody remembers the words Culture Wars, which is the name of the book, but nobody remembers how he actually defined the culture wars. The subtitle of the book was The Struggle to Define America. It might have been The Battle to Define America. Anyway, The Struggle to Define America. And what he meant by that is he had always, as a sociologist, had always taken history courses that stressed America was divided on religion between Protestants and Catholics and Jews. And it was kind of like horizontal strata of American life, you know, with Mormons different from Catholics, different from Baptists who are different from Episcopalians. And all of this is going sideways. It was in the mid to late 80s that he began testifying in a lot of trials about battles between secular humanism and religious faith, and cases involving abortion was the big issue in the mid-80s to late-80s. But then he began to see the gay rights thing beginning to come up. And whenever he got in these trials, he suddenly realized that the major division in American life is no longer between, say, Protestants and Catholics or Catholics and Jews. He said the major division is over the very definition of truth. How do you define truth? And he divided America into what he called the camp of the progressives. And progressives feel that truth is an evolving concept rooted in making sense of your own personal experience. So you have your truth, I have my truth. I may have a different truth later in my life, but that no one can take our truths away from us. The camp of the small o Orthodox believe that there are eternal, revealed, big word here, transcendent truths. And I told him I had seen the exact same thing. In that column, here's how I opened that column. I take just a few minutes to say this. Back in the 1980s, I began to experience deja vu while covering event after event on the religion beat in Charlotte, Denver, and then at the national level. I kept seeing a fascinating cast of characters at events centering on faith, politics, and morality. A pro-life rally, for example, would feature a Baptist, a Catholic priest, an Orthodox rabbi, and a cluster of conservative Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Lutherans, etc. Then the pro-choice counter rally would feature a moderate Baptist, a Catholic activist, a Reformed rabbi, and liberal mainline Protestant, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, or Lutherans. In other words, if you walked up and looked at the two rallies, you would say, wait a minute, these are the same groups. I mean, here's the Lutherans, and there's Lutherans on the other side. But if you don't know the difference at that point between biblical authority debates between Missouri Synod Lutherans and ELCA Lutherans, you don't know much about what's gone on in the last 50 years, right? Or if you don't know the difference between an Orthodox Jew and a Reformed Jew, or between a Southern Baptist and an American Baptist, what he had spotted here was that America was now divided not by religion, but by concepts of truth itself. And I thought that was a fascinating insight that explained so much of what I had seen in my time as a religion reporter. So when I say that that's kind of like an overarching concept for my work as a columnist, I thought that 10 years into the column, and I still think that 30 years into the column.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about trends in religion news, reflecting on his 30 years writing the On Religion column. When we come back, what he calls the death of the liberal First Amendment coalition.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. This glorious good news is and always has been too good not to share. It compelled Peter, Paul, and the other apostles to the very ends of the earth, and it continues to drive Lutheran Church Missouri Synod missionaries even today. Learn more here in the April issue of The Lutheran Witness magazine. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Elementary School Association is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During April, if you open a federal FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the Lutheran Elementary School Association. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about trends in religion news over the last 30 years. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, another observation you'd like to bring forward is what you call the death of the Liberal First Amendment Coalition.
Well, first of all, let's just give ourselves a bit of a framework for what 30 years is like. The election of 1988, when the column begins, do you remember the winner of the 1988 presidential election?
I do.
Okay, George Herbert Walker Bush. And that means Clinton comes along 4 years later and 8 years later. So the first decade of my column was written during the era of Herbert Walker Bush and then both Clinton administrations. Now, when I say that there was this old coalition, the perfect way of examining that is that in 1993, so 5 years into the column, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, if it's all Restoration Act, is as it's always called, that passed in the U.S. Senate by a vote of 97-3. There were only two Democrats who voted against it and one Republican who voted against it. If you tried to repass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, similar to the language being used in all the battles in American states in last year's, what do you think the vote in the U.S. Senate would be today?
I think it would I'd probably have to be a tiebreaker. Who knows?
I don't think there would be. I think now, because major corporations have switched their position on religious liberty and the First Amendment so much, I don't think you'd have a chance to pass that today. And back then, it was considered liberal to be in favor of protecting religious minorities. But then over time, it became a battle between religious liberty and sexual liberty. And everyone would agree, but people on the left and the right would agree that much more so than the abortion issue, it was the gay rights issue that tore this coalition of left and right, tore it completely apart. Every once in a while, you see flickers of this coalition, and you begin to realize that there used to be kind of a broad consensus on religious liberty. And I think the most important one that we saw was in the Hosanna-Tabor decision in 2012, the Lutheran school decision, when the U.S. Supreme Court voted 9-0 to say that religious institutions could use doctrine as a way of shaping their community, that they could, in effect, enforce doctrine on people who, to some degree, were performing something that could be called a ministry within their doctrinally defined organization. It's very interesting. I read a story just this morning in the mainstream press that made it sound like this concept of a ministerial exception and a doctrinal covenant made it sound like this was really some sort of remote, weird, brand new concept for which there wasn't much support. And I was thinking to myself, what part of 9-0 on the Supreme Court do you not understand? How many 9-0 decisions have we had at the U.S. Supreme Court lately, let alone on something involving religion? So that when I say the death of the liberal liberty consensus, what I meant is that just as recently as the early years of my column, the Clinton-Gore administration, which last time I checked was not known for its close affinity with the religious right, the Clinton-Gore administration was proudly promoting helping write and shepherding through the legislative process things to protect religious minorities. Fascinating change in a quarter of a century.
You also observe, and this is an observation you've made many times recently, that demographics are destiny. The question is, which religions are growing?
Yeah, we talked about that just about a week or two ago, or was it just last week, about the European study. I'm amazed how journalists are not terribly interested in the basic questions of why some religions grow and why some religions fade. And when you link up all of the important stories that are related to that, I always think it's amazing that we see with good cause. We see these regular stories about the Catholic priesthood and the struggles of the church to get enough priests, and yet nobody ever stops and says, well, of course, several decades ago, when they had lots of priests and nuns, the average Roman Catholic family in the United States had somewhere between 3 and 5 children. And today, the average birth rate for Roman Catholics is under 2, not even to replacement. As a seminary president once put it to me, if you're a Roman Catholic family and you have 2 children, and one of them's a son, do you want that guy getting married and having grandchildren, or you want him to run off and be a priest? Isn't that a rather elemental question? But it seems we don't want to talk about demographics at the level of birth rates and everything else. As I said just last week, I mean, basically it boils down to what religious groups are having children, are evangelizing those children and retaining them, and what religious groups are then making converts. Those three questions have a lot to do with all kinds of stories. I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm in New York at the moment. All over New York, there are Catholic schools closing. Why are the Catholic schools closing? There aren't enough Catholic kids. Why are there not enough Catholic kids? We're right back where we started. So now you have this story that on one level, it looks like a real estate story. What's going to happen to these churches that are sitting on prime pieces of real estate in New York City? What's going to happen to all this? But how do you write that story if at some point you don't say, what happened to the schools? What happened to the parishes that used to fuel those schools? It's like a law of gravity in religion. Children, retaining children, and converts. And yet, over my 30 years doing this column, I've been amazed how rarely I see those questions asked. And of course, I've seen that in Get Religion as well as in my work as a columnist.
My own denomination, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, recently commissioned some demographic study because, like every denomination known, it has experienced decline in the last 30 years, and they wanted to see it in the context of demographics, the kind of questions like birth rates and things like that. And what they discovered was the damage was done 30 years ago. It was done 30 years ago when Lutherans started having less children, and it tracks perfectly with the decline of the overall numbers of our church body, or in some cases, the plateauing of those numbers. Is that the kind of practical thing you're talking about?
Of course. I mean, and it's also interesting to me that urban, probably lower blue class German Lutherans coming over from Europe with all of this tremendous tension and turmoil in their lives and making all these changes, and they can't speak the language, and their education levels aren't the same, they're probably having more children than well-off, Lexus-driving, suburban Lutherans outside of American cities today. And when were the Lutheran schools stronger? It's amazing. The Missouri Synod Lutherans are interesting in the sense that they are sociologically they're mainline Protestants, and theologically they're more creedal, or even confessional or evangelical are the big debates among the Missouri Synod Lutherans. But y'all are a unique bunch. You have conservative doctrines, but you still act like liberal Protestants. It's like you're sort of honorary liberal Protestants still. We could do a whole show on that, but you don't read many stories that really capture that, do you, in the mainstream press, that really see the tensions within Lutheranism at that level?
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here again.
Terry will be back with us tomorrow to continue our conversation on trends in religion news. We'll discuss the splits forming in American evangelicalism, not just political, but theological as well, and how, well, in a country ruled by evangelicalism, how celebrities rule it all. On This Week in Pop American Christianity tomorrow, we're going to talk with Chris Roseborough about Mark Driscoll's return. He is back in a slightly different form, but back nonetheless, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. If you're in the market for a new or used car, check out Lutheran Federal Credit Union's car buying service at lutheranfcu.org, lutheranfcu.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, good for you, good for the church, lutheranfcu.org. We'll find out how Mark Driscoll is coming back when we talk with Chris Roseborough tomorrow. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholz. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to eighth grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.